McCaffrey.
We please the court. First time in front of this court.
Welcome. We're a very, very nice court, so it'll be fine.
Well, the facts of the case are pretty simple. They're pretty straightforward. I represent a company called State and Wholesale. We have an office, and our main office is in Dallas, and we're a national company. We're all over. We've got warehouses all over the country. We initially had a number 800-888-8888-888, and then we got very excited when 888-888-888 became available. Made sure we got both of them. In 1998, we had the all eights number. Shortly after we got it, we started thinking, you know, this number is so incredibly easy to remember that we might be able to put it to even a better use than as our fax machine. We always thought that in the back of our head. So we incorporated a company called All Eights LLC. We secured three trademarks that all have to play on the name of the All Eights. At one point in time, however, in June of 2001, we discovered we no longer had the number. And here's what happened. On October 27th, somehow or another, the number got disconnected from State and Wholesale, and it just supposedly was no longer ringing to us. 2 days, well, that was a Friday. The following Tuesday, somebody from FDC, Call Interactive, contacted MCI. FDC is a huge company. In fact, the person they contacted at MCI, they're her only client. Said, hey, this number's not working. Can I have it? So what did she do? She gave it to them. On November 2nd, she reassigned the number to them. This was all at the hearing in front of the FCC, at the board hearing. Federal regulations require that numbers are not to be assigned from one end user to another directly. I've quoted the section, chapter, and verse. It is just required in there. It is not to happen. Numbers are supposed to go into a lag time status, and then they're then available per the regulations to everyone on a first come first served basis. I think the reason was that they didn't want people to sell numbers, and that was the whole point behind that. We continued to get billed, even though the number got reassigned on November the 2nd. We continued to get billed through the next year. It was then assigned to FDC in January 4th, approximately. At some point in time after that, they switched carriers over to Sprint. That was kind of the coup de grace when we found out about the number, because we were going to use it for another company. So what we couldn't have it as our main fax number. So we put it as like a second alternate fax. We were continuing to use the number. We were weaning our customers off of it. So then we could start up the new number.
So all these things that you're saying in the record?
Yes. They were all in the record. They are all in the record.
That you were weaning your customers off of it? This was all in the record?
I believe it's in our petition, our complaint that was filed before the FCC. The whole background of it was all in the petition before the FCC.
If we can just sort of move past the background just for a moment.
Yes, sir.
What do you do with the bankruptcy court?
I knew that was I absolutely knew it was going to be your first question. Okay, first of all, the bankruptcy issue.
Then you're prepared.
It is a direct assault on it, but at most it only impacts the willful conduct.
Well, let's leave out the at most. Is there any at least?
I mean, oh, yes. What argument
do you have that paragraph 5 doesn't cap the damages at $1,000?
Well, because it says in the event that I'm reading paragraph 5. Yes. In the event that the FCC determines that the debtors are liable for negligent but not willful reassignment of the all-eights number, then the parties agree that Staten's claim for damages only.
Yes.
I have claims other than.
I'm only asking about the damages. You agree that you're done on the damages, then?
No, because with regard to the willful, perhaps. I mean, I'm not going to stand up here and argue my. There are points here that
not with
I'll die on these hills if I try them.
Well, but let's see where you're dying at least. So let me just read you this sentence, and you tell me whether you're dead, okay?
Yes.
The parties hereby agree that Staten's claim for damages only shall be liquidated in the event that the FCC determined that the debtors are liable for negligent and not willful reassignment, then the parties hereby agree. And that is what the FCC determined, right?
Yes.
Okay. Then the parties hereby agree that Statton's claim for damages only shall be liquidated at the tariff cap amount of $1,000 and shall be allowed in that amount and not subject to further appeal. That means us, right? Further appeal. That's what you're doing now.
Yes.
Okay. So you agree that you are capped now at $1,000 in damages. Is that right?
Yeah. As far as the willful conduct, I believe that I don't see how I'm going to get around
right. And that you can't dispute whether the conduct was willful or not for purposes of the damages, because you've agreed that it's not subject to further appeal. That's us.
Yes. However, I do believe that I have about three arguments on that. One, it doesn't apply to equitable relief.
Gotcha.
Second, it doesn't apply to my claims for newly discovered evidence that they then need to rehear.
Well, why isn't that a question about subject to further appeal? Aren't you appealing right now? And your part of your appeal is newly discovered evidence.
No, I see your argument, but
just an observation. You have filed an appeal with this court. One of the grounds of the appeal is you have newly discovered evidence, but you
yes.
agreed that this was not going to be subject to further appeal. So how do we get to your newly discovered evidence?
Well, I believe that this does not countenance newly discovered evidence, because I believe that this court. I believe that if the FCC should have considered my newly discovered evidence, that is, it's almost as if my case was not final.
Well, why is that different from an argument that the FCC failed to consider the evidence that was already before it, or failed to give a good explanation, or was arbitrary and capricious? All of those arguments would reopen the whole, if we were to agree with you, that would reopen everything. But then the clause that says not subject to further appeal would mean nothing.
I see your point, Your Honor, but I just don't believe that it would apply to something that was newly discovered that would not have been presented to them in the first place. Because they can't make a finding on something that they didn't have in front of them in the first place. And so, if they should have reopened the record,
so you want to identify the newly discovered evidence. Anything else? So we have equity and newly discovered evidence. Anything? Equity meaning an injunction ordering the reassignment of the number. Anything else? We're talking about what's left open by this.
Okay. Well, you've got the subsequent to this case finalized, this petition. They had several lawsuits, and that's been brought up. One of the cases was against FDC. That was the company that was not allowed to be part of the proceeding before the FCC because they were not a common carrier. We wound up in a lawsuit with FDC to try to get the number back. When we went through the depositions of the FDC people and we got responses to discovery from them, we discovered a couple of other things. One, that this Denise Nielsen, she doesn't mention this at all before the board, but we found out that she was their only customer. And what would happen is FDC would call and ask about a number.
This is newly discovered evidence, right?
Yes, this is all newly discovered evidence.
So I understand. That's the category. So you have two categories here of arguments available.
And a third one.
What's the third one?
I also believe that pursuant to 47 U.S.C. Section 206, that is a provision that says that in the case of any common carrier shall do or cause to be done any act, matter, or thing in this chapter prohibited. In other words, this provision provides that if you violate a federal regulation, if a common carrier violates a federal regulation, then they're liable for the full extent of the damages.
Yes,
and there's no requiring of willful in that one.
Maybe, but how does that get you out of paragraph 5?
Because it's not willful.
It doesn't ask whether it's willful. It says, in the event the FCC determines that the debtors are liable for negligent reassignment, which is what you want, right? Even under 206, that's what they did.
Yes.
Then the parties are limited to $1,000. So
well,
even if you were right about 206.
Well, my interpretation, and it might not be correct, and I could be ruled against in this, obviously. My interpretation is that paragraph 5 says to us, you can't appeal it. You can't appeal the willful. If they find negligent but not willful, then that, because it even says that, if it says it determines that you're liable for negligent but not willful, it applies to the finding of negligent but not willful. It doesn't apply to the other provisions that we could have, that we sued under, but including the equitable. And in fact, I believe that
hold for 1 second, but it says then the parties agree that Statton's claim for damages only shall be liquidated at $1,000 and shall be allowed in that amount and not subject to a further appeal. That's the claim for damages that shall not be subject to further appeal. It's not the finding of willfulness or negligence, it's the claim for damages.
True, but it later in the provision, and I have to find the actual bankruptcy code.
It's JA 341.
341, thank you, Your Honor.
No problem. It's my job.
Number seven.
Ah, okay.
Except as specifically provided herein, the debtors in Statton reserve all rights and remedies under the letter agreement, MCR agreement, bankruptcy code, and any other applicable law. So there, what I'm saying is that they are, other than this willful and negligent, not willful, we have reserved the rights for or any other claims for relief.
Okay. Let me
and
ask.
That was my response to that.
Now, of the other categories that you talked about, the new evidence, this Ms. Nils, is that her name?
Nilsson.
Yeah,
and she later became Ms. Chalupka, so she's Nilsson Chalupka.
Okay, good enough.
Same person.
Okay. I take it the opposition side is that you knew she existed and you could have deposed her before we get to this, before the FCC decided the case.
Right, and I was not the counsel at that time.
Well, I'm not blaming you, and I'm not even asking about
it. Right.
When I say you, I mean your client, not you. So is that right? Could they have deposed Ms. Nilsson at the time?
They were only allowed, from my review of the record, Statton was only allowed 5 interrogatories. That was the extent of the discovery they were allowed.
No depositions?
No depositions.
I thought the government was suggesting that you could.
Say that, but all I know is that this was this occurred. They went to a status hearing. Bob Miller, from Gardier and Wynn, I believe, was the counsel. He's listed in there. He went to what he thought was a status hearing, and he had sent out the five interrogatories and gotten the responses from that. And he was not allowed to take. There was no discovery at all other than that.
Was she identified in the?
They provided her affidavit. And that's the evidence that I've cited that in there. But her affidavit only says a couple of things. The newly discovered evidence is all the other stuff that came up with the fact that Ms. Nilsson would get calls from FTC and ask to reassign a number. And we know that's the federal regulations say you're not to do that. She did it all the time. In fact, she says that one time she had to give the number back. That was part of the newly discovered evidence. And she said that they would do it, figuring that if somebody squawked and say, hey, wait a minute, what's wrong with my number? They just give it back. They violated federal regulations all the time with the idea that we could just clean it up if somebody makes a stink. If Statton had called a couple of days later, it'd be no harm, no foul. Sorry, turn it back. And that was newly discovered evidence that was not considered. And they didn't have it in front of them to consider it. And I think it's, you know, the situation is everyone is going to agree it's awful that this happened. You should never have lost the number. You should have the number now. But we're left with nothing. I mean, I had a client, an elderly client one time when I first started practicing law. He said justice requires three things. It requires, one, knowing your rights. Two, having the wherewithal to go through with the procedure to get your rights. And the third one, and the hardest one, is someone has to be willing to give it to you. Someone's have to be willing to give you justice at some point in time. Trier of fact, and judge, whatever. We're at that point. It's uncontested that the number was taken from us improperly and that it should be our number. And all we keep getting is, and we sat for 6 years before the FCC to get this ruling back. It took 6 years to get this ruling.
And so McCaffrey, you're sort of over time. You want to end
we're
up?
We're just saying that at this point in time, we would like the chance to finally get our number back. I appreciate that, Don.
Ms. Smith?
May it please the court.
Could I ask you about that last point, second to last point, the question about whether depositions were takeable before the FCC?
Yes. Generally, the 208 complaint proceedings are decided on a written record, but there is an opportunity to request depositions. In this case, the Staten automatically had the opportunity to propound up to 10 interrogatories without requesting additional discovery from the commission, but Staten only propounded 5 interrogatories. And in those interrogatories,
what rule gives them 10? Is this a practice or is this a rule somewhere?
It's under the discovery rules. It's 47 CFR 1.729.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
And in her,
know if they
Ms. Had, Nielsen was identified in the answer that Sprint filed in to Staten's complaint, and also she was identified again in the answers that MCI filed to Staten's interrogatories.
And could they have deposed her or not?
They could have asked for a deputy to depose her, but Staten did not ask for any additional discovery, even though she was identified as someone with information. And in her affidavit, she set forth the same facts that Staten tried to bring in through her deposition. All of those facts were already a part of the record before the agency.
When you say all those facts, does that include this idea that she would routinely violate this statute or regulations with respect to reassignment?
She did not testify that she routinely violated any regulation in her
deposition.
Do
we have that?
Yes. If you look at page
maybe if you could tell me both where her affidavit is and where her testimony is, that would be helpful.
Okay. Her testimony that I was referring to is at page 479 of the joint appendix, and her affidavit is at page 390 of the deposition.
Of the joint appendix?
Of the joint appendix. And in her affidavit, she explains that Call Interactive contacted her after it discovered that the number had been disconnected and asked her to check on the availability. And when she checked on it, this is from her affidavit, she discovered that the number was disconnected, and so she assigned it to Call Interactive rather than releasing it to the spare pool. So Staten had an opportunity before the agency to pursue its theory that Ms. Nielsen's actions in reassigning the number constituted willful misconduct, and it did not.
Okay. I think Judge Brown had a question.
No.
Go ahead.
And so at bottom, Staten failed to carry its burden that MCI acted willfully, which means with a knowing intent to cause harm to Staten in disconnecting and reassigning the number. Staten seems to suggest that because the disconnection and the reassignment caused it harm, it forgets that it has to show that MCI took those steps in order to cause harm to Staten, that there was no connection between the disconnection and the reassignment. And even if...
Well, there would, I guess, if there had not been the reassignment, by the time they woke up to the problem, could they have gotten it back? That is, if it was still in the spare pool, wouldn't they have been able to get it back? without the problems that happen once it's reassigned to someone else? When you say no,
perhaps if the number had been disconnected and it remained in the spare pool by the time Stanton discovered the error, then of course it could have gotten it back. But because by the time the error was discovered, Stanton could not get the remedy it sought for the negligent disconnection, because by that time the number was no longer available to be returned to Stanton. It had been reassigned to a third party using it.
Right, but when you said there's no connection between the reassignment and the harm that they suffered, there is a connection, or at least there's an arguable connection. That is, had it been in the spare pool, it could have just been given back.
Yes, and I'm not suggesting that they did not suffer harm and their inability to have the number returned, but for it to be willful misconduct, Stanton had the burden of showing that MCI intended to harm Stanton in making the reassignment. And in this record, MCI was not even aware that the number had been disconnected erroneously until Stanton contacted MCI in June of 2001 about the disconnection. And in Mrs. Nielsen's testimony, she testified that she would not have reassigned the number to call Interactive if she had known that it had been disconnected in error. And that's at page 488 of the joint appendix, where Stanton's counsel questioned her, and he asked, if you had known that Stanton had not authorized the transfer of the telephone number, would you have transferred it to FDC? Answer, no. And so there isn't anything in the deposition that indicates that MCI was acting willfully to cause harm to Stanton when it reassigned the number. Unless the court has any questions.
Does the court have any questions? Well, tell me just what you just read. Was that what page and what line?
That's at page 488 of the joint appendix. It starts at line 6 through line 10.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We have Mr. Miller, who asked for 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Chris Miller for Intervenor Verizon. Judge Garland, you are correct, and using your words from this court's decision in Charter Communications v. FCC, there are a couple of showstoppers here. The first you keyed in on...
I don't think I invented those words.
And not today, Your Honor. At least not in my view, Your Honor. You've keyed in on the bankruptcy stipulation. The bankruptcy stipulation is an absolute bar to this appeal in this situation. The stipulation applies to a situation where the...
Not an absolute bar to the equitable claim, though, right, to reassignment.
Not to the equitable claim, Your Honor, but the equitable claim is essentially moot at this point. There's no party before the court against whom equitable relief could rely. MCI no longer has the number and cannot give it back. Sprint no longer has the number and cannot give it back.
This may be over as far as you're concerned, but the FCC is still a party here, and I suppose if they made an error in refusing to order it, they could order whoever has it now to return it. Maybe that's a loser argument, but it's still an argument. It's not foreclosed, right?
It may be an argument, Your Honor. Here today, counsel for Stanton offers three reasons why the bankruptcy stipulation might not apply in this situation. None of them work. First, newly discovered evidence. The bankruptcy stipulations by its terms is not limited to, it does not allow Stanton to advance an appeal based on newly discovered evidence. Second, under Section 206, Section 206 doesn't add anything to this claim. It's simply the provision of the Act that allows for damages. And Staten in this situation has waived its right to appeal on damages. Your Honor, the second showstopper you also asked about, Staten absolutely could have requested before the FCC to take Ms. Nielsen's deposition testimony under FCC Rule 47 CFR 1.729H. Parties are, in fact, permitted to take depositions. But they have to ask, and Staten never asked in this situation. This case is not unlike this court's decision in American Message Centers v. AT&T, where the court expressly upheld the FCC's Section 208 complaint.
Did the FCC ever agree to those kind of requests? I had the impression the FCC rarely permits depositions.
Section 208 complaints are typically resolved on a written record, but the FCC does on occasion grant requests for depositions when depositions are warranted. But the FCC cannot grant such a request unless asked. Staten never asked. Thank you, Your Honor.
Did he make it within 2 minutes? No. 45 seconds over.
Really?
Your next case, we're going to take that away from you. Mr. McCaffrey, you're out of time, but since this is your first time here, we'll let you have a rebuttal.
I will be extremely brief and get straight to the point. Your Honor, you asked about that standard operating procedure to transfer the numbers. That is found at JA 473. I asked him, was it standard operating procedure when FDC called and asked about a number, and if that number was disconnected or on hold, for it just to be transferred to FDC's account? That's how I normally handled the situation. And then they would call the account team. The other account team would say, yes, you can have the number, or no, it was done in error, and please return the number to us, at which time I would. So you actually had assigned numbers to FDC and had to return them later? It happened once.
Let me ask you, though, what do you do with the lines that Ms. Smith pointed out from the deposition of Ms. Nielsen Chalupka?
Yes.
That she was asked, if you had known that Staten had not authorized the transfer, would you have transferred it to FDC? No. And her point is that willfulness requires knowledge that there'll be injury.
There are two events here. The October 27th disconnection is one event. That was I don't have any evidence to prove there was anything other than an accident. However, on October 31st. Ms. Nielsen transferred the number to FDC. I asked her in her deposition, are you aware that regulations require that disconnected numbers go spare?
Pause over. Just.
Yes, sir. Listen,
here's the question. So the definition of willful misconduct in the FCC, example is the Jerry Murphy case, is that it has to be done with knowledge that the omission will probably result in damage or injury. And she says at JA 488 that she wouldn't have done this if she'd known that Staten hadn't authorized the transfer.
I think that's true, but I don't think she intentionally attempted to harm Staten. However, I don't think you have to have a mens rea to specifically harm the individual person.
Where in her deposition, what's your best argument that she did it with knowledge that it's going to damage or injure anyone?
Well, she says, are you aware? Well, first of all, she's already assigned numbers in the past and had to give them back.
That's how she knows that she shouldn't be doing this. But how does she know that it's going to
Well, she knows that someone could be using that number and that they could be damaged. And she's deliberately violent. She says in there, the one thing I think that we can't forget is the fact that she admits in there, I said, you are aware that regulations require disconnected numbers to go spare and be offered to the general public? I know disconnected numbers go to the SMS pool after 45 days, and that number never did. No, right. That was JA 475. She then goes on later to talk about at 478 and 479 how the numbers, she would put the number over there for FDC so that they wouldn't lose the number. I mean, she had a standard operating procedure of violating federal regulations, and they're there for a reason. And to say that she didn't know that someone could be damaged, she knows she's taking someone's number. She just thinks she has a plan B to fix it. But in this particular case, it didn't work because they were a little quicker. I do think it's, you know, why were they so quick in moving? Does anyone think it's interesting that this number got disconnected on October 27th on a Friday, and on a Tuesday FDC called up and said, this number's available. Can we have it? They acted very quickly to move this number, and then they transferred the number to another carrier.
What happened to this lawsuit that where she testified?
We were not able to prove a case against FTC because they did not transfer. You see, we were kind of a.
In other words, you lost.
We lost, but let me say it's a catch 22, Your Honor. Though.
A ruling by the Dallas District Court.
Yes, there was, because MCI transferred the number, FDIC did not.
FTC
did not. We lost, and on the other side. We're in a catch-22. We couldn't win the case against FDC because MCI was the one that transferred the number, so we have to come back here.
FDC still have the number?
No. No one is using this number, which gets me back to the very rationale that the court, that not the court, but the FCC said, we're not going to give you back the number because a company's using it. And there was a company at the time of that hearing, Mills Fleet Farm, a company in Wisconsin, was using that number. But after the fact, and that was one of my second petition for reconsideration, we started, I have someone that checks on the telephone number industry for me. He called me and said, hey, your 888 number's not ending anywhere. So we had people from Wisconsin calling. The number doesn't ring through anywhere. We talked to somebody from Sprint, I believe, and he told me, well, it's, you know, and it's all in there.
So if no one's using it, why doesn't your company request
someone
the FCC to assign it to them?
There is a company that, a RESPorg. You see, there's a RESPorg which has the authority over the number, and then, of course, you've got your end user, which is actually using it. At this point in time, it appears that it is a shell game. This arrest board has the company, but this has the number, but this number has not been in use since 2005. Someone's hoarding this number, probably waiting for everything to settle down, and then the number can be used, and so that they won't, that
no
risk.
Call Ms. Nielsen up and say, please assign it to us.
I'm going to tell you this. I think that if anybody at this table had been able to turn around and give us the number back, in fact, when we talked about this, what do you want? The number? Have the number back? That's really the thing we want. We want the number back. And nobody's using it.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate it, and we'll take the case under submission.
Thank you.